content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the April 28th, 2017 issue of the Week magazine. The cover of the magazine this week shows an older model red convertible zooming down a busy street, and at the wheel is Kim Jong-un. In the back seat of the convertible are three missiles, nuclear warheads. He's grinning wildly. The front plate on the car says, "Boom, North Korea, the Hermit Kingdom." And in the very foreground is a blue car going straight at him. And the title says, "Playing Chicken, Trump's Exchange of Military Threats with Kim Jong-un." And with that, we'll go into the main stories and how they were covered. Trump, North Korea escalate threats. What happened? The U.S. and North Korea exchanged threats of military action this week as the regime of dictator Kim Jong-un made a bristling display of its ballistic missiles, and Vice President Mike Pence warned the era of strategic patience is over. At a parade in Pyongyang to celebrate the birthday of the nation's founder, Kim Il-sung, North Korea, displayed dozens of medium and long-range missiles, including rocket canisters big enough to fit international ballistic missiles, ICBMs, which could carry a nuclear warhead to the U.S. mainland. Satellite imagery has led U.S. officials to fear that Kim planned to mark his grandfather's birth with the nation's sixth underground nuclear bomb test. But after fierce warnings from the U.S. and rumors of a preemptive strike, the regime instead tried to launch a ballistic missile, which crashed within seconds of liftoff. Some analysts suggested that U.S. cyber sabotage may have caused the failure. President Trump has said he would not allow North Korea to build an ICBM, and on a visit to South Korea, Pence warned the Hermit Kingdom not to test Trump's resolve. Trump has been urging China, North Korea's main economic partner, to use its leverage to curb the country's nuclear program. In an embarrassing admission, the White House was forced to acknowledge that its claim last week that the aircraft carrier USS Carl Vinson was on its way toward the Korean Peninsula was false. The warship was in fact heading south to engage in naval exercises off the coast of Australia and won't arrive in the Korean region until next week. The White House blamed interdepartmental miscommunication. What the editorial said: strip away the bravado and hype, and the goal of Trump's not-so-veiled threats is clear, said the Washington Post. He's trying to crank up the pressure on China to rein in its client state, then push for a negotiation in which the U.S. will offer to leave Kim in power if he agrees to halt his nuclear program. But this strategy has been tried by previous presidents without much success. If that history is repeated, what then? By threatening North Korea with unspecified action, the Trump administration is playing a dangerous game, said the Baltimore Sun. China won't impose economic sanctions severe enough to cause Kim's regime to collapse, because then Beijing would lose its geographical buffer against Western-backed South Korea. North Korea won't back down on its nuclear and missile development. Kim's aides frequently cite the fact that Libyan strongman Muammar al-Qaddafi was ousted and killed after giving up his own nuclear program. A preemptive strike on Kim's nuclear facilities would trigger a North Korean counterattack against Seoul and result in hundreds of thousands of casualties. There really are no good options. What the columnist said, U.S. administrations have kicked the North Korea can down the road since the 1953 armistice, said James Robbins in USA Today. But if we leave it much longer, one of the most unstable regimes in the world will have the capability to kill millions of Americans at a stroke. That's why the administration is reportedly considering a decapitation strike to take out Kim and his top commanders. Trump's tough talk appears to have gotten China's attention, said John Pomfret in the Washington Post. A worried Beijing threatened North Korea with unprecedented ferocity if it tested a nuclear device last weekend. Amid all the nuclear brinksmanship, the farcical mix-up over the whereabouts of the USS Carl Vinson is alarming, said David Graham in the Atlantic.com. The dysfunctional Trump administration is evidently so capable of communicating basic information between the White House and Pentagon that it can lose track of an aircraft carrier. What happens when the stakes are much higher? Americans shouldn't panic over North Korea, said Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. Not even if the nation develops an ICBM with a nuclear warhead capable of reaching Washington. Kim is not suicidal. Indeed, his only goal is survival. He knows that he and his country will be obliterated if he ever does press the nuclear button. The West's best move is to ratchet up diplomatic and economic pressure and wait for Kim's illegitimate and impoverished regime to implode, be it in 7 months or 70 years. As the experience of the Soviet Union showed, even having the ultimate weapon will not stave off regime collapse. Our controversy of the week, MOAB. Is Trump growing too fond of military force? On the campaign trail, Donald Trump vowed to make the U.S. military so strong that he'd never have to use it, said William Estor in Salon.com. But in the past 2 weeks, Trump has turned out to be a commander-in-chief who deploys military power with gusto, if not abandon. First came the cruise missile attack on Syria, whose civil war Trump, the candidate, had said was none of our business. Then last week, U.S. forces dropped the largest non-nuclear bomb in our arsenal on a network of ISIS tunnels and caves in a remote region of Afghanistan. The 21,600-pound massive ordnance air blast bomb, MOAB, known colloquially as the mother of all bombs, was developed in 2003, but was never deployed until now. Is anyone really surprised that this is happening, said Lucy Steigerwald in DailyCaller.com. For all his earlier talk of restraint, how could Trump, of all people, resist the temptation to start setting off the best, the fanciest, the most expensive weapons in the world? America is back, said Charles Krauthammer in NYDailyNews.com. Trump's swift, decisive actions in Syria and now Afghanistan have put the world on notice that President Obama's 8 years of agonized hand-wringing have officially ended. Paradoxically, the most likely result of this theatrically effective show of force will be a more peaceful world, as dictators in Pyongyang, Damascus, and Moscow will have second thoughts about testing Trump's resolve. Obama micromanaged America's wars and tied the general's hands, said David French in NationalReview.com. That led to a mindset of timidity. Trump declared last week that he has given the military total authorization to deploy tactics and weaponry such as MOAB as they see fit. That's a change that's long overdue, and it will make our armed forces more effective. Don't be so sure of that, said Kimberly Dozier in thedailybeast.com. By delegating tactical decisions to the men he calls my generals, Trump risks running up large numbers of civilian casualties, as he already has in the battle for Mosul in Iraq. Killing innocents is a surefire way to alienate people in the nations where we battle for hearts and minds as well as territory, and can lead to more, not less, terrorism. Generals are better at tactics than at geopolitical strategy, said Jeffrey Sachs in the Boston Globe. Ultimately, the big decision about whom to attack and with what must be made by our impetuous, unstable, and inexperienced commander-in-chief. That's terrifying. In Trump's ego-driven confrontations with other nuclear powers, one big mistake could end the world. In the short term, Trump's unhinged impulsiveness may actually be effective, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. He's unwittingly relying on what Richard Nixon called the madman theory of geopolitics, a strategy in which a world leader acts as if he's capable of anything, including nuclear war, thereby making other nations more cautious and willing to negotiate. In the long term, however, erratic national leaders often lose allies who seek out more dependable protectors. Wily enemies such as Russia's Vladimir Putin and China's Xi Jinping, meanwhile, may learn how to use Trump's impulsivity to trick him into emotion-driven, self-defeating actions. The president is right to try to revive the deterrent power of our military might, said Victor Hansen in NationalReview.com. But no one should underestimate the risks here. After 8 years of American passivity and retreat, aggressive nations such as China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea will bristle if Trump insists they back down. However, just our cause, we are entering a dangerous moment. It was a good week for redistribution. After a Massachusetts man received a check from the U.S. Treasury for 2 cents, Air Force veteran Bruce Rideout, 79, doesn't know why he got the check and doesn't plan to cash it. Instead, he paid $82 for a custom-made frame to display it. It was a good week for starting and finishing after researchers at the London School of Economics found that personal happiness tends to peak at ages 23 and 69. That's because of the surge of optimism that comes with entering the workforce and the relief that comes with leaving it. And it was a good week for working for Dad after China approved 3 trademarks for Ivanka Trump's jewelry and spa brands the same day that the president's daughter and advisor dined with Chinese President Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago. The deal opens the world's most populous country to Ivanka's branded goods and services. But it was a bad week for Alex Jones after his lawyer said during a custody battle with Jones' ex-wife that the conspiracy theorist host of InfoWars doesn't really believe the nonsense he spouts on his internet show. He is playing a character, the lawyer said. He's a performance artist. And it was a bad week for Bill O'Reilly, who was fired by Fox News after a mounting number of sexual abuse allegations by female colleagues against its top-rated talk show host, including five lawsuits settled for $15 million. O'Reilly called his dismissal tremendously disheartening. And it was a bad week for honesty, after a video camera caught Sperry, Oklahoma Police Chief Justin Birch doing nearly 80 miles per hour while driving home. Birch wrote himself a $300 ticket, but when asked if he had admitted the offense if not caught on video, replied, "Probably not." And before we leave the page, here's a boring but important short. Trump's crackdown on skilled worker visas. President Trump this week signed an executive order that clamps down on guest worker visas and favors American companies for federal contracts as part of his administration's Buy American, Hire American agenda. The order, signed by Trump at a Wisconsin factory, calls for a review of the H-1B visa program for skilled foreign workers and directs federal agencies to use U.S.-made iron and steel in projects and buy more goods and services from U.S. companies. We're going to do everything in our power to make sure more products are stamped with those wonderful words, "Made in the USA," said Trump. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said Trump's order was just words and wouldn't create a single job. Turning to the briefing page, we have France's populist uprising. Far-right nationalist Marine Le Pen has a chance to win the country's presidential election. What's propelling her rise? What is at stake in the election? France is having a contentious argument about what it means to be French. An influx of immigrants from former colonies such as Algeria and Morocco, and a much higher birth rate among those groups, is rapidly transforming the country's demographics. France is about 8% Muslim overall, but some 25% of French high school students are Muslim. That's caused alarm in a nation repeatedly struck by radical Islamist terrorism. So has Muslim religiosity in a nation with a rigorously secular culture. At the same time, the inflexible French economic system, with its strong welfare state and rigid labor laws, has struggled to adapt to globalization. Unemployment is stuck at 10% and is 26% among those under 30. The split between the educated elite of Paris and the left-behinds of the small towns has deepened into what author Christophe Guilly calls a total cultural fracture. France, he says, has become an American society just like all the rest, with its identity-based tensions and paranoias. In the first round of France's presidential election on April 23rd, the same forces that pushed Britons to choose Brexit and Americans to choose Donald Trump could produce a victory for Marine Le Pen's National Front and a political earthquake for all of Europe. Who's running? There are 11 candidates in the first round, but only four stand a chance of making it to the May runoff of the top two vote-getters. Center-right Republican candidate François Fillon, a social conservative who wants to reform labor laws and cut spending, is polling last of the four because of accusations that he paid his wife and children for phantom government jobs. Upstart far-left populist Jean-Luc Mélenchon, polling third at about 19%, wants to withdraw from NATO and free trade pacts, boost worker benefits and reduce the work week, and impose a 100% tax rate on incomes above $430,000. Centrist Emmanuel Macron, a dashing young banker and economics minister who promises to save the middle class by investing in vocational training, is at 24%. But the focus of the election is on the nationalist Le Pen, also polling at 24%. She wants France to turn its back on Europe and immigration and return to uniquely French customs and traditions. What would Le Pen do? Le Pen sees Frenchness as under attack from three forces: Islam, the EU, and globalization. She would defend it by halting immigration from former colonies and amending the Constitution to establish the primacy of Christianity. To throw off the tyranny of EU regulations made in Brussels, Le Pen promises a referendum on continued membership, raising the possibility of a Frexit that could utterly destroy the Union. She also wants to take France out of the euro, the shared European currency, and bring back the franc. Her policy of economic patriotism would punish firms that relocated factories abroad and would protect French farmers with tariffs on imported food. Who are her supporters? National Front supporters are largely working class, small town residents who feel that globalization has left them behind and replaced traditional local shops with big box stores. Many of them are deeply mistrustful of Islam and horrified that France's historic but half-empty churches are falling into disrepair while new mosques spring up. Le Pen has plenty of youth support from a burgeoning alt-right movement called the Identitarians, who say France is being reverse colonized by its former colonies in Africa. Le Pen also has the support of Russia. How is Russia involved? French banks refused to lend the Nationalist Front money, so Le Pen turned to Russia for funds in 2014. Nearly $10 million came from a bank with ties to the Kremlin, and Le Pen repaid that with nearly total support for the policies of President Vladimir Putin. She said Moscow had the right to take Crimea from Ukraine and has vowed, if elected, to lift EU sanctions against Russia. Macron, meanwhile, has alleged that cyber attacks against his campaign and a proliferation of pro-Le Pen fake news stories on social media are being orchestrated by Russia, a charge Moscow denies. What's clear, though, is that Russia supports the far right all over Europe. He knows the extreme right divides us, says European Commission Vice President Frans Timmermans, and a divided Europe means that Putin is the boss. Who will win? The last time the National Front got into the runoff under Le Pen's father Jean-Marie in 2002, the entire French establishment, left and right, closed ranks against him, and he took less than 18% of the vote. But the mainstream parties that have taken turns ruling France for decades are out of favor, and their establishment is largely dead. If Macron makes it to the runoff, he is favored to win. But Le Pen could upset him if Mélenchon supporters, who regard Macron as an ultra-capitalist, stay home in disgust. And if Mélenchon makes the second round with Le Pen, the choice will be between an anti-EU pro-Moscow candidate of the ultra-left or an anti-EU pro-Moscow candidate of the ultra-right. Almost anything could happen. About a week before the election day, 40% of workers declared themselves undecided. It's time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. First, the EPA's toxic betrayal. When you bite into a strawberry, said Timothy Egan, you shouldn't have to think about childhood brain development. But now you do, courtesy of Donald J. Trump. In his zeal to abolish government regulations, the president is putting chemical industry toadies between our food and public safety. Trump's EPA chief, Scott Pruitt, recently rescinded a proposal ban on chlorpyrifos, a pesticide that research has linked to neurological damage in children, including lower IQs, ADHD, and autism. The pesticide was banned from household use 20 years ago, but is currently in wide use in commercial agriculture on about 50 types of crops, including berries, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, apples, and peaches. During the Obama administration, the EPA proposed banning the chemical based on studies of its potential impact on human health. But the election changed everything. Trump and his cronies see anxiety over poisoned food, water, and air as alarmist whining and plan to gut research into a host of chemicals linked to cancer and birth defects, supposedly in the name of job creation. Not incidentally, the maker of chlorpyrifos, Dow Chemical, gave $1 million to Trump's inaugural committee. What a stunning betrayal of public health. Why we need local newspapers. Over the past 15 years, U.S. newspapers have cut their workforce by more than 50%, from 412,000 employees to 174,000, said Margaret Sullivan. That's an underappreciated tragedy because strong local reporting is our primary guardian against rampant corruption and official wrongdoing. This year, a 37,000 circulation West Virginia newspaper, the Charleston Gazette-Mail, won a Pulitzer Prize for digging deeply into the opioid crisis devastating that community. The newspaper, whose unofficial motto is Sustained Outrage, found that drug wholesalers shipped 780 million hydrocodone and oxycodone pills to a single pharmacy over 6 years, fueling a sky-high addiction and overdose rate. Other newspapers won Pulitzers for exposing police abuses in New York City and campaigning against pollution in rural Iowa. Though local TV stations and websites do some reporting, research shows newspapers produce 85% of accountability journalism. This journalism is disappearing as advertising dollars and staffs shrink. As a result, many local and state governments are now going largely uncovered. When public officials know nobody's watching, they inevitably abuse their power. Sustained outrage is vitally important. So is keeping it alive. This is an international How They See Us column. Shockwaves from the mother of all bombs. President Trump is hell-bent on pursuing a military solution in Afghanistan, said Esmudasir Ali Shah in Dawn from Pakistan. Washington didn't send a single representative to Moscow last week for the latest round of talks on Afghanistan, in which diplomats from Iran, Pakistan, China, and Russia explored the prospects for peace between the central government in Kabul and the Afghan Taliban. Instead, a few hours before discussions began, the U.S. dropped its most massive non-nuclear bomb, the 21,600-pound mother of all bombs, on a complex of tunnels and caves in the Tora Bora Mountains currently being used by ISIS. More than 90 militants were killed, and the blast was felt on the Pakistani side of the border as well, damaging a mosque and several other buildings. It's ironic, of course, because those very tunnels were built with massive funding from the CIA in the 1980s for the Mujahideen to use in their fight against the Soviets. The U.S. builds in Afghanistan, and the U.S. bombs what it has built to oblivion. It's hard to disagree with former Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who denounced the brutal use of our country as a testing ground for dangerous weapons. Nobody listens to Karzai anymore, said the Daily Afghanistan in an editorial. Under his administration, many opportunities to fight terrorism were lost because he opposed U.S. raids on terrorist hideouts. In fact, most Afghans approve of this latest U.S. bombing, both because ISIS has become a scourge in the region, murdering innocents in suicide attacks, and because there were no civilian casualties. Now that our government has shown it is serious about fighting terrorism with our international allies, a great wave of hope has emerged among the people. But it's counterproductive to fight the extremists in this country, said Hiwad in an editorial. All too frequently, innocent Afghans are killed by U.S. bombs, their relatives are radicalized, and the land is poisoned. The war on terrorism should go on, but we want to fight the terrorists in our sanctuaries, and we want to fight against the countries nurturing terrorism. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, the Haqqani Network, the Taliban, all of these extremist groups that are now slaughtering Afghans receive training and funding across the border in Pakistan, the mother of terrorism. If the Americans are truly serious about combating terrorism, they will stop sending money to Pakistan and start dropping bombs there instead. The U.S. really doesn't care about stopping terrorism here, said Wisa from Afghanistan. The Americans didn't drop a $170,000 bomb on this country of poor, hopeless, and defenseless people because they thought it was the only way to eliminate a few dozen cave-dwelling radicals. No, they wanted to show off their expensive armaments and scare their rivals in Russia, North Korea, and some other countries. 16 years after the U.S. first came to Afghanistan, our nation is now little more than a bombing range. We damn this barbaric war. Our last word article takes us in a different direction from so much of the current political news. It's titled, The Grandest Farewell. Queen Elizabeth II is the only monarch most Britons have ever known, said journalist Sam Knight. The plans for her elaborate 10-day funeral showcase all the pomp and grandeur of a long-gone empire. In the plans for the death of Queen Elizabeth II, most versions envisage that she will die after a short illness. Her families and doctors will be there. When the Queen Mother passed away on Easter Sunday in 2002, she had time to telephone friends to say goodbye and to give away some of her horses. In these last hours, the Queen's senior doctor, a gastroenterologist named Hugh Thomas, will be in charge. He will look after his patient, control access to a room, and consider what information should be made public. The bond between sovereign and subjects is a strange and mostly unknowable thing. A nation's life becomes a person's, and then the string must break. There will be bulletins from the palace, not many, but enough. The king's life is moving peacefully towards its close, was the final notice issued by George V's doctor, Lord Dawson, at 9:30 p.m. on January 20, 1936. Not long afterward, Dawson injected the king with 750 milligrams of morphine and a gram of cocaine, enough to kill him twice over, in order to ease the monarch's suffering and to have him expire in time for the printing presses of the Times, which rolled at midnight. Her eyes will be closed and Charles will be king. His siblings will kiss his hand. The first official to deal with the news will be Sir Christopher Geight, Queen's private secretary, who will contact the Prime Minister. The last time a British monarch died, 65 years ago, the demise of George VI was conveyed in a coded phrase, Hyde Park Corner, to prevent switchboard operators from finding out. For Elizabeth II, the plan was for what happens next is known as London Bridge. Prime Minister will be woken if she is not already awake, and civil servants will say London Bridge is down on its secure lines. From the Foreign Officials Global Response Center at an undisclosed location in London, the news will go out to the 15 governments outside the UK, where the Queen is also the head of state, and the 36 other nations of the Commonwealth for whom she has served as a symbolic figurehead, a face familiar in dreams and the untidy drawings of a billion school children since the dawn of the atomic age. For a time, she will be gone without our knowing it. The information will travel like the compressional wave ahead of an earthquake, detectable only by special equipment. Governors general, ambassadors, and prime ministers will learn first. Cupboards will be opened in search of black armbands, 3¼ inches wide, to be worn on the left arm. All news organizations will scramble to get films on air and obituaries online. At The Guardian, the deputy editor has a list of prepared stories pinned to his wall. The Times is said to have 11 days of coverage ready to go. At Sky News and ITN, which for years has rehearsed the death of the Queen, substituting the name Mrs. Robinson, calls will go out to royal experts who have already signed contracts to speak exclusively on those channels. When people think of a contemporary royal death in Britain, they think inescapably of Diana. The passing of the Queen will be monumental by comparison.